From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Radio Boston.
Science!
Science!
Evidence!
Evidence!
Scientists took to the streets this weekend, but what happens next? And a disturbing new report finds a sharp increase in anti-Semitic incidents here in Massachusetts. Also today, tech billionaire Elon Musk wants to meld the human brain and computers.
Over time, I think we'll probably see a closer merger of biological intelligence and digital intelligence.
And author Jessica Shattuck on her new book about three German women during World War II.
What did ordinary Germans, the people whose lives sort of touched very peripherally on the darkness, experience during that time, and how did they let this happen?
All that coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tanya Mosley.
We are living in a time when science and public education are being attacked on a fundamental level.
Several thousand people gathered on the Boston Common this weekend in support of science and to protest proposed cuts by the Trump administration. Here's Harvard Medical School Dean Dr. George Daly. He says the plan to cut 20% of funding for the National Institutes of Health would have a cataclysmic effect.
These cuts are antithetical to the ideals of our nation. Science is at the heart of an informed electorate and a democratic society.
There wasn't just a big showing here in Boston, but also at rallies throughout the world, which leads us to what happens next. To answer that, we're joined by Harvard professor Naomi Oreskes. She teaches the history of science. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
So how would you characterize this moment in history for science? Do you feel that it's under attack?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think there's no question that's true here in the United States, not necessarily globally. But here in the United States, for sure.
Specifically to the United States. And can you talk just a little bit about that?
Well, many scientists have become aware of the problem since the election of Donald Trump because of the large cuts to science that he's proposed, as we heard the previous speaker say, and also because he has specifically targeted certain programs like satellite data collection at NOAA that are relevant to issues like climate change, which profoundly affect people's lives. And the fact that he's targeted these climate data-related programs speaks to a political agenda to try to essentially eliminate data that is inconvenient to certain interests, certain political interests and economic interests. So it's very disturbing for scientists, and it's been a kind of wake-up call for the scientific community. But from my perspective as a historian of science, this is the culmination of something that's been going on in the United States, unfortunately, for quite a while, really since the late 1980s or the early, well, actually even earlier, since the 1980s. In my book, Merchants of Doubt, with my colleague Eric Conway, we showed how there's actually been a kind of systematic attack on science related to environmental issues and public health in the United States, pushed by a kind of network or consortium, or network is probably the best word, of interests, mostly commercial but also ideological, who have resisted accepting scientific data that pointed to serious problems that needed government intervention.
So you're saying this goes back several decades?
Yes, and if you push it even further, what we showed in our work was that the strategies and tactics had actually been borrowed from the tobacco industry attack on science related to the harms of tobacco use. So in that sense, this is a story that begins more than 50 years ago, but has reached a kind of alarming crescendo in recent months.
So for many of us are really learning about this for the first time because of these marches all around the world, have scientists taken a public or activist role like this before?
Not really. I mean, we've seen that sometimes in the past when particular sciences have been under attack, for example, attacks on evolutionary theory here in the United States, scientists in those fields have sometimes become active and taken a public position to try to defend their particular scientific areas or even a particular theory like evolutionary theory, but we haven't seen what we saw this weekend, which is a broad-scale mobilization of scientists across the board speaking up not just to defend a particular area of science like climate science or a particular theory like evolutionary theory, but in fact to defend the entire enterprise of doing science.
One theme that we heard from several people on Saturday was that scientists have to get out of the labs and engage with the public. Can you talk a little bit about why this is important and what that would really look like?
Well, I think it's terrifically important because one of the reasons why attacks on science work is because most people are pretty confused about science. Science can be confusing. My particular area of interest is earth science and particularly climate change, and climate science is complicated. There's no getting around that. So it's easy to confuse people, and it's easy to make people think that the science is unsettled and we don't really know. So that makes it really imperative for scientists to stand up and reach out and say, well, actually, the science is complicated. That part is true, but although it's complicated, there are a lot of things we do know. Many things are complicated. Relativistic physics is complicated. Plate tectonics is complicated. DNA is complicated. And yet, we know a lot about these things. And if we take the time, we can explain them to our fellow citizens in ways that they can understand. And I think that's an urgent task right now, because when people don't understand the science, then it is very easy to create confusion and to create the impression that, well, we don't really know if there's climate change, so, you know, let's just not do anything about it.
Well, this whole act, this whole thing, this march and really this effort has brought about a lot of tension we're finding in the scientific community. Are you worried that activism might damage the objectivity in research? That's kind of like the talk that many have brought up with folks that were out there covering it over the weekend. I'd love your thoughts on that.
Well, this was exactly what I spoke to at our pre-rally at Harvard on Saturday morning at 9:30 before we all walked together to the Common. I think that that represents a profound misunderstanding of the character of scientific objectivity. And I love science. I love scientists. I used to be one. I'm married to one. I spend most of my time with them. But scientists themselves can be quite ignorant of areas outside of their own research. And many scientists carry rather confused ideas of what it means to be objective as a scientist. So we have, my field is not a super old field, but it's been around for about 100 years. And there is a lot of research and study about what does it mean? What is scientific objectivity anyway? And all of the work that's been done in this area has really come to one conclusion, which is that it's a mistake to think about objectivity as a characteristic that inheres in an individual. So many scientists will say, I am objective. And some scientists will say, and therefore I can't get involved in politics because that would compromise my objectivity. Well, that's just silly because, of course, we all have views, and no person can expunge from their brain their values, their views, their orientations,
biases,
their beliefs. That's an impossible task. And it's not even desirable because we have lots of good neuroscience data that shows that even if we could expunge our feelings, it would actually be a bad thing because we need feelings and we need views in order to reason in the world. So objectivity is not achieved by suppressing your personal opinions. Objectivity in science is achieved through the social practices of science, the practices of critical scrutiny, of arguments among scientists. Melissa Franklin emphasized this in her talk. It's not an opinion because it's not just what I say, because I have to now present the data to my colleagues who will argue with me, who will present competing hypotheses. It will have to go through peer review. It will have to be tested. And the strength of science and the objectivity of science comes not from the attitude that I bring to my work as an individual, but comes from this collective process of critical scrutiny that I am part of.
So what's the next step beyond these rallies beyond the discussion?
You know, I'm not a political organizer, even though climate deniers will accuse me of that. I am a scholar and an academic, and I write books and articles, and I study things, and I try to understand them. But I think the most important thing that's happening now is for scientists to grapple with the fact that we are in a political situation, that science is involved with society, and in that sense, it has to be at least to some extent political. And the idea that science could exist in a vacuum, it's not that, again, history refutes that notion. Scientists have always had to grapple with how do we explain what we do to people? How do we make the case for why other people should support what we do? Scientists have always needed patrons. And in America, in the 21st century, our patrons are the American people. It's the American taxpayers. So we have to make the case to our patrons for why what we do is valuable, why it improves their lives, and why they should support it.
Naomi Oreskes is the professor of history of science at Harvard University. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So we're joined now with our WBUR Common Health blog host, Carrie Goldberg. And Carrie, you were at the March for Science over the weekend.
Yes, right? I was at the pre-rally at Harvard Medical School.
I'd love to know what was most striking to you.
Well, the thing that has struck me most in general the last few days is that it's not just a lot of scientists and students really sort of taking to the streets and stepping out. There's also a lot of institutional support from the leaders of these institutions, the dean of Harvard Medical School, the president of Massachusetts General Hospital. And that has surprised me the most because these are institutions that usually try to kind of stay out of politics, but they seem to be seeing a threat to their core mission. And so they're actually speaking out.
To their core mission. You also listened to quite a few of the speeches. What were some other things? You said that there were students there. There were folks that were also not really even part of the scientific community, but supporters of this effort.
Yes. Well, there were patients who said in so many words, my life was saved by science. Mm-hmm. And so you can see where their support is coming from. It's very personal as well as political.
Okay, so as we saw on Saturday, Boston is a hub for the science and tech communities. But now we're going to turn to California, where Elon Musk, the tech billionaire, best known as the CEO of Tesla, the electric car company, and SpaceX, the space exploration company, is turning his attention to the human brain. His latest venture, Neuralink Corp, is working to merge the human brain with computers. And Musk says the technology could be used to help people with brain disorders in just 4 years. Okay, so this new company that Elon Musk is founding will be in the San Francisco Bay Area. But Carrie, this sort of technology is already around here in the Boston area, correct?
Right. We're a hotbed for this kind of technology. It's what's called a brain-machine interface. And there's been quite a bit of work done on it here in Boston, as well as in Providence at Brown. Even like more than a dozen years ago, as researchers here were already experimenting with inserting implants into paralyzed patients' brains so they could channel their brain's electrical signals so they could, in effect, turn their thoughts into movements. And at first, it was pretty primitive. It was just like trying to move a computer cursor on a screen. But now it's reached the point where they could like help a quadriplegic patient control a robotic arm to lift a cup and actually drink from a straw. And there's also a more advanced project underway here in Boston that's funded by the Department of Defense. And it's trying to create a brain implant that can both detect when your brain is going awry. Like, let's say you're a veteran who's about to get a PTSD flashback, and then try to head it off before it hits.
Okay, so there's been a lot of work around this on the medical front here in Boston, but what exactly is Elon Musk talking about doing?
Well, it can be a little hard to separate the hype from the reality, but there's really a lot of buzz building right now about his claims that maybe within a decade or so, you and I and others could actually enhance our brains directly by linking them to computers. And I mean, sort of the way our brains are linked to our smartphones now, but this would be a biological link. So like some sort of implant in or on our heads, actually augmenting our brains. And Musk raises the possibility that this could eventually lead to sort of a computer-assisted telepathy. Like, say I went to a birthday party yesterday and you asked me how it was, I could like sort of beam the images from it, my brain to your brain, right?
Okay.
It's easier than trying to describe it to you, right?
Okay, so I can't be the only one that's skeptical of this brain sharing. We know that a few weeks ago, Facebook actually announced that in 2 years they will have this skull cap type thing that can transmit sentences, but this is on the outside, so we'd put it on like a literal skull cap. But, I mean, what are some other people saying about all of this type of technology?
Well, so you're right. You're not the only skeptic. And, in fact, right now on the website for the MIT Magazine Technology Review, the reporter Antonio Regalado has a piece out that's saying, basically, Elon, like, really? Because he thinks the timeline that Musk is putting forward is really unrealistic, both technologically and because brain implants are medical devices, and those always take a really long time to be approved. And they take especially long, if you think about it. It's not even for people with diseases. It's just to upgrade your brain.
Okay, I want to keep you here for more on this discussion. But for a reality check, we're joined now by Dr. Emory Brown. He is the professor for computational neuroscience at MIT and a professor of anesthesiology at MGH and Harvard Medical School. Hello, Dr. Brown. Welcome.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, so Musk said this technology could be available to those with a disability within 4 years and potentially available to everyone within 8 to 10 years. And he hopes merging computers and the human brain will help mankind keep up with advancements in artificial intelligence. He's been optimistic about the ability for tech to rapidly advance. Here's Musk at the World Government Summit in February.
I mean, the first controlled powered flight was 1903 with the Wright brothers. And then 66 years later, we put the first people on the moon. I mean, that if you'd asked people, say, in 1900, what are the odds of, you know, man landing on the moon, they would have said, that's ridiculous.
Dr. Brown, I'd love to know from you, could this analogy, do you think this analogy also applies to Neuralink?
Yeah, I think it does to some degree because, I mean, we do have to really try to reach and, you know, really go after, you know, hard problems with, you know, the resources, you know, that are needed. So I think that, you know, one thing's for sure, if we don't ever conceptualize solving a very challenging problem like this, you know, we never will. And, you know, we can certainly have debate about, you know, the time scale, but I think thinking big is really what's needed here.
From you, I want to know, has brainwave reading technology been successfully implemented before?
Oh, it certainly has. I mean, there are, you know, a few examples that were cited earlier, like, you know, the brain computer interfaces that are used to, you know, to help some patients maybe with locked-in syndromes move a cursor, patients that are, you know, quadriplegic move a cursor or indicate, you know, indicate choices on a tablet. There are also examples of even enhanced performance with helping patients that have had brain injuries, helping them sort of, you know, relearn, you know, tasks and this sort of thing. So, and there's been success also with in the area of depression, like work done by Helen Mayberg down at, you know, Emory University, you know, implants to help stimulate and help people feel better. So there have been successes.
Okay, so the eventual purpose is helping human beings really medically and also keeping pace with advancements in artificial intelligence. But beyond the medical side of things, do you see this being as something that's good for humanity, good for mankind, to ultimately for us, as Carrie said, be able to send me, we've been using the term telepathically, but to be able to send me pictures from a birthday party or those types of things?
So quite frankly, that's a bigger normative discussion, you know, and I think that, you know, it's very, very difficult to sort of really, you know, summarize all the issues there just in a couple of, you know, sound bites. But I think the key thing that has to happen is, as ideas like that are positive, I think the ethics around it and the implications around it have to be studied up front and not sort of after the fact.
Carrie, what do you think about this?
Well, so I would just like to ask Dr. Brown, I mean, it just seems like this is such a technologically hugely difficult task. Like, and you're working on this extremely advanced implant that struck me as just barely on the edge of doable. Do you think what Elon Musk is talking about is actually doable in a span of years?
Well, I think that there's a lot that we have to learn to really have this work and understand why it works. You know, might there be some successes just from some empirical endeavors? We might locate some brain sites such that we're able to maybe help improve depression another way, or, you know, help treat patients with depression. Those sorts of advances are certainly possible. But then we have to realize there are some things we've understood for a while, and even though we've understood why the pathologies are there, we still haven't successfully treated them. Like, and a good example is like Parkinson's disease. Mm-hmm. I mean, we know that there is a deficiency in dopamine in certain circuits of the brain, and yet we still haven't been to com- completely able to rectify that. So even in cases where we really understand what we need to do, we still have to, you know, we're still quite not there. And so, for example, if you look at the deep brain stimulation, which is done to treat like Parkinson's disease, it's successful, but then the why of it is still a mystery.
Dr. Brown, what do you believe some challenges will be for Neuralink as they push forward with this type of work?
Well, I think that I would probably like to see a lot of emphasis on the biology and the neuroscience of what's going on in the brain, and then using the artificial intelligence, if you would, to help better understand that, and then once that's understood, then to think from a therapeutic standpoint, as opposed to thinking because we just have large amounts of computational power, and if we just interface that with the brain, things are going to happen. It just seems like putting the emphasis on using the computational power to understand the physiology and the neurocircuitry of the brain is where the successes are going to come.
Carrie, so is it even maybe a little frivolous to use to talk about brain enhancement when we need so much just treatment?
Mm-hmm. No, I don't think it's frivolous, because we have a lot of, you know, if we think of patients that have had, you know, traumatic, you know, brain injuries, and they certainly need, you know, enhancement, if you would. And in other words, they need enhancement. You know, if you're thinking about enhancement for the sake of just taking us from our maybe typical situation into a situation where we might be smarter, faster, that sort of thing, it would be probably more productive to put the emphasis on trying to help the people who need it first and then think about the other later.
Well, thank you for that. That's Dr. Emery Brown. He's a professor of computational neuroscience at MIT. And as always, it's lovely to have you here, Carrie Goldberg, the host of WBUR's Common Health blog.
Thank you, Tanya.
Thanks to both of you guys.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks.
Salem police issued a statement today regarding a swastika that was painted on the Salem bandstand. This on the same day that the Anti-Defamation League is out with a new report that shows a dramatic increase in the number of anti-Semitic incidents across the country. This report comes as we commemorate Holocaust Remembrance Day. The report shows Massachusetts ranks 5th in the nation for anti-Semitic incidents, despite ranking 15th in the population in the nation. And these anti-Semitic incidents are coming from a population that might surprise you. Joining us to discuss these numbers and what they mean is Robert Treston, the executive director of the Anti-Defamation League of Boston. Hello, Robert. Thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
So tell us, what types of incidents are we talking about when we talk about anti-Semitic incidents?
Well, we're talking about incidents anywhere from people being harassed to vandalism to assaults. So it runs the gamut. And, you know, not all, you know, every incident involves a person, a complainant, and is deeply personal to that individual. Some of these things don't end up in police reports or in crime stats because they don't always rise to the level of a criminal offense. But that doesn't mean that they're not anti-Semitic or they're not a hate incident.
So specifically in the report that you all produced, in the huge increase, does that also include assaults as well?
Well, we did not see an increase in assaults, particularly
okay.
in Massachusetts. The real concern for us here in Massachusetts was a large increase in harassment and a large increase in vandalism. And what the data showed us was that the vast majority of incidents were occurring in schools. And interesting, when you break it down by time of the year, the summer months when schools are out of session were also the quietest.
So specifically K through 12 you're talking about, like, or just high school, middle school?
Middle and high school. And, you know, that's sort of consistent with some of the news reports that we've been reading, you know, for the past 12 months. And it's also consistent with the number of calls that we've been getting from schools across the Commonwealth asking for assistance and resources in responding to incidents.
Why do you think specifically with young people we're seeing an increase?
Well, we're living in a very you know, we're living in a challenged time with a heightened sense, a heightened political atmosphere. And one of the things that's different now that even didn't exist was maybe 2 years ago is the existence of smartphones and access to technology and information. And in the past year, people are speaking in ways that they didn't before. And some of the hate, some of the vitriol that for years was on the fringe is now part of the mainstream. And because of technology, everyone from teenagers on up have access to it.
So what you're saying is kids are just more exposed to anti-Semitic messages?
I think kids and, you know, everyone has a different level of exposure to all forms of hate and bigotry. I mean, Holocaust and Nazi analogies are much more common now than they were a couple years ago. And we're not just they weren't sort of the lone example, but we're reading about them now in mainstream media.
And so why do you think that is? Why do you think that why are we hearing about it more? Why are kids having more access to it?
Well, the access is easy. It's just a matter of technology.
Right. Well, technology. Why do you think that we actually have more?
Well, I think it's unfortunate that a lot of leaders are using it as part of their talking points. And, you know, there are ways to express your disagreement. There are ways to express your point without invoking hatred or without targeting someone or using, you know, stereotypes or symbols or analogies. And we're living at a time now when that's become all too common.
When you say leaders, are you specifically talking about our country's leader, Donald Trump, the president?
Well, I don't think it's fair to blame one person for all of this, and I certainly wouldn't put it all on President Trump. And so when I say leaders, I'm talking about everyone. Clearly, the president is part of that, but so are the leaders in our state. So are the leaders in our communities. And so in many ways, we all have a responsibility to be mindful of the language that we use, the words that we're using, and how we choose to make our point. Because people are listening, and too often the youngest people in the communities tend to, they're out there repeating some of it. And some of them may not be prepared or may not have the right context.
I'm curious from your perspective, because you've been doing this work for a long time, what do you feel is different from this year versus, say, last year or 5 years ago? Kids have had technology for quite some time.
Well, I think, you know, the smartphones are clearly have advanced in the last number of years. But it's the level of public discourse that has changed. And whereas people may have made a once in a while offhanded comment in the past, we're seeing it much, much more common. And, you know, unless leaders are prepared to step up and unless we really put some educational measures in place, people are going to continue to act this way.
I'd love to know, too, as part of your reporting and what you found, what are some ways that maybe schools are calling on you guys and saying, hey, we're having these incidents happening. What are some ways that these types of schools and folks are trying to tackle this issue?
Well, one of the things that's really important is that we shouldn't run away from an incident. And the data shows us that no community is immune, whether it's affluent, inner city, public or private school. And so we encourage schools to be transparent, to communicate, and to drill down, find out what happened, how it happened, why it happened, and to engage students in discussion. And use opportunities when something happens as real educational opportunities to identify who the student leaders are and to work with them. And
we touched on this earlier, but I want to circle back to it. Why do you think specifically Massachusetts, though, has seen such a large number as opposed to other states?
You know, it's hard to sort of say one reason why Massachusetts. I think one of the things about Massachusetts is we have a real heightened awareness of incidents. And, you know, at the beginning you mentioned, you know, where Massachusetts ranks in terms of population. And it always strikes me that in Massachusetts we have a high number of hate crimes that are actually reported to law enforcement. And I would not always look at that as a negative number. I would say that people are not afraid to report things here. Mm-hmm. And when people report things, they tend to do it because they have some level of confidence in a system, that if they report something, someone's going to do something about it. And I think it's really, you know, it's important for kids and parents to report things if their child experiences something in a school. And we want to be living in a community where our school administrators are responsive and putting measures in place. And if something rises to the level of a crime, we want to ensure that law enforcement are trained, that they're going to respond, and when appropriate, prosecutors are going to also act. Those are all big pluses in the system here.
Well, that's Robert Treston. He is the executive director of the Anti-Defamation League of Boston. Robert, thank you so much for joining us to talk about this.
Thank you.
And listeners, a little later in our show, we'll talk with author Jessica Shattuck about coming to terms with discovering her grandmother was a Nazi in her new book that explores the lives of three women amid the ashes of Nazi Germany. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tanya Mosley. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tanya Mosley. Harvard University has put its ties to slavery on display with a new exhibit that documents three slaves that lived and worked on the Ivy League campus. WBUR's Fred Tice has this report.
Research by Harvard students indicates that at least three Harvard presidents owned enslaved people. One was Benjamin Wadsworth, president of Harvard from 1725 to 1737. He lived in what is now known as Wadsworth House. It's a yellow house on Massachusetts Avenue that is the second oldest building at Harvard. Archivist Juliana Kuipers shows us Wadsworth's diary.
It lists here the purchase of a Negro girl. Her name is not given in this record. She's only referred to as a girl thought to be about 20 years old. But we have found through the church records, which are also available and digitized, that her name was likely Venus.
Three other enslaved people are known to have lived and worked at Wadsworth House. Two were owned by the next president of Harvard, Edward Holyoake. But there may be more. On display is a diary by one of Holyoake's daughters.
And she has several references to a woman named Pharaoh. And again, we don't know for sure, but it's possible that she was also enslaved. So this is, again, sort of another nugget for people to follow up on and see if they can find any more conclusive evidence.
The exhibit is the idea of Harvard president Drew Faust. She says the university's connections to slavery came to her attention in part because of students' research in a seminar on Harvard and slavery.
And this resonated very much with me because of my own scholarly interests, which are in the history of the American South and the Civil War. And a direction in that scholarship in recent years, the scholarship of slavery in the United States, has been to look at New England and to discover that New England was much more involved in slavery than had been previously understood and researched.
One of the students who conducted the original research, Avery Williamson, lives and works in Philadelphia now. She was able to identify one enslaved person who lived and worked at Wadsworth House.
I didn't really think at the time that much would be made of it, but I think for it to be seen at this level and to be considered as a really integral part of Harvard's history, it's just, it feels like really good work to have done as an undergraduate, you know, meaningful.
The person Williamson identified was named Titus. Faculty minutes from March 21, 1740 note a decision to forbid students with associating with Titus, a quote, mulatto slave of the late Reverend President Wadsworth. Titus was prohibited from entering the campus, and the university steward was prohibited from sending him on errands or as a messenger. A plaque commemorating four enslaved people who lived and worked at Wadsworth House now hangs on the house. A committee of historians is advising President Faust on the next places on campus that should be noted. One place of note, Beck Warren House. It's possible that it was a stop on the Underground Railroad. History professor Robin Bernstein brings students in her course in Childhood in African America here. In 1833, the house was built for Latin professor Charles Beck, who was an abolitionist. It contains a secret trap door that opens onto a secret room.
This was not any kind of an afterthought. This was not added decades later. Take a look.
The trap door reveals a small space not high enough to stand in. In the 1940s, when workers discovered the room, they also discovered an enclosed shaft fitted with a metal spike ladder that led to the basement. Bernstein doubts that the room was used in the Underground Railroad.
There's actually very little evidence of white people ever altering their homes to create secret spaces to hide fugitives from slavery. So if this is, in fact, a secret space that was created in order to hide fugitives, it would be truly unique. So that doesn't mean that it couldn't have been created for that purpose, but it would be beyond unusual.
Harvard is considering an app that would offer self-guided tours of the university's connections to slavery. Faust says because she's a historian of slavery, she's not surprised by the discoveries.
But detailing them brings a past to life in a way that is so important. And I think you can see that in putting the names on Wadsworth House. It says these are real human beings whose lives were stolen by slavery.
One of the original student researchers, Justin Harbor, now a high school history teacher in Pennsylvania, commends Harvard for encouraging research into its connections with slavery.
They're trying to leverage their authority and their stance in higher education to sort of bring attention to this problem. And I think that that's wonderful and absolutely a step towards some form of justice with respect to this institution.
But Harbor would also like to see Harvard consider some sort of reparations. So does Faust see that as possible?
Well, I think we have to understand what the dimensions of our engagement have been more fully and how we repair that as a society, as a university, as a society. I mean, one of the aspects of these investigations of slavery on university campuses that I think is important to remember is this was happening on our campuses because it was so much a part of our society.
The Harvard historians advising President Faust emphasized that it's important to continue to investigate the university's connections to slavery, and so she's authorized the hiring of a researcher to study the archives.
That's WBUR reporter Fred Tice. The Harvard Archive exhibit is open through Friday. You can find more information about it on our website, radioboston.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tanya Mosley. I loved my grandmother, but she was a Nazi. This is what my next guest, Jessica Shattuck, recently wrote in the New York Times. She goes on to write, "Understanding why and how this woman I knew and loved was swept up in a movement that became synonymous with evil has been, for me, a lifelong question." Shattuck's new novel, The Women in the Castle, takes up the question of how ordinary people respond to a regime that commits horrific atrocities. Who resists? Who is complicit? And why? Shattuck follows three women through the war and through their attempts to rebuild their lives in a time of peace. Jessica Shattuck, who is based here in Brookline, joins me now. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
So we mentioned at the top your New York Times piece and that headline that said, "I love my grandmother, but she was a Nazi." Tell us how you found out about this and why it was so important for you to say that.
Well, in a way, I always knew, but I didn't know. I knew that my grandparents were ordinary Germans. That was sort of the term that I put on their existence and their experience of the war that in some ways I think distanced the reality. And I didn't know exactly what that meant. Mm. But I did know growing up, my mother, who immigrated to this country when she was 19 and never moved back to Germany, definitely raised me with a strong sense of shame about my German heritage. Mm. And so I knew that ordinary Germans wasn't a good thing. But I guess I didn't have too fine a point
on what that meant, right, and what happened and the reasons why. In what ways did your family history and this story, as you came to learn about it and grow into it and learn the stories from your grandmother, play a part in this book that you wrote?
It was a huge force. I don't think I would have written this book without that. I think that I, you know, as I said, I grew up hearing these stories of my mother's childhood in post-war Germany, and they were fascinating to me. They were so different. Her childhood was so different than my own American childhood, and her stories were full of things like walking to school barefoot and being woken up early to eat an egg before her sisters woke up so they wouldn't be jealous because there was really only one egg for the family to share. Even though they raised chickens, the rest had to go to market and be sold. She would stay home from school to help in the harvest. So these were kind of these exotic, interesting stories. But as I got older, I really wanted to understand more about why was that? I mean, my father had stories about growing up in America in the same time period, and they were not as
like
drastically
this.
Different. Mm-hmm. So that kind of led to a lifetime of fascination with trying to understand what that time after the war was like, and also what the war itself was like from the German point of view and in the German experience.
Tell me a little bit about the discussions you had with your grandmother as you came into what this was and the gravity of it. Did you talk very specifically about her time there?
Yeah, I did. My grandmother was very, she was an unusual woman in that she really wanted to talk about this subject. I think many people of her generation don't have that feeling at all. If anything, they just want to sweep it under the carpet or avoid it, and partly for fear of upsetting themselves, for fear of upsetting others. And my grandmother, I think, really wanted to be understood. And I spoke very in a lot of detail with her about it. When I was 15, my mother passed away. And so I never got the chance to ask her a lot of the questions that as I grew older, I had about her childhood and about that time. And so my grandmother was kind of a substitute. And I spent a summer there when I was in college interviewing her. And it started with mostly asking about that time after the war and my mother's childhood. But then, of course, it went back.
Mm-hmm. You have three main characters in this book, and their names are Marianne, Benita, and Anya. And these three women have three very different reactions to the rise of Hitler. How are you trying to capture the German experience differently with these three women through their particular outlooks?
Yeah, I wanted to make sure that I really, as I started writing this story, I wanted to be sure to cover a sort of span the gamut of the German political experience of that time. So while the book is framed through the three women being the widows of resistors, as the story unfolds, you learn that they're all very different and, in fact, not all exactly who they at first appear to be. And I really wanted to look at the experience of one of them, the main character, Marianne, is a resistor in her own right and is someone who saw the evil of Hitler and the danger Hitler posed unfolding very early on and recognized that and began to take action as much as she could as a woman. And so she's kind of at one end of that spectrum. And then we have another character, Anya, who you learn was really swept up in the promise of Hitler and Nazism and excited by that in the beginning. And I wanted to have these two ends because I feel like they each shed light on each other. And to me, that's a fascinating question. Why did some people see what was happening and recognize the dangers for what they were, and others remained either blind or willfully blind or self-delusional?
Yeah, you talk a bit about Anya being an idealist, and you also use the same descriptors of your grandmother.
Yeah, that was one of the things that I thought was, something that really fascinates me is that you think of it as like someone who is a resistor would be, you wouldn't be surprised to hear they were an idealist because it would be like, well, of course they resisted. They were following their ideals and were guided by that from the start, whereas someone who went along with Hitler, you know, probably was just going along. But in fact, something that I learned from my grandmother and that I think is actually not so untrue of many people of her generation, maybe especially women, was that there was a kind of idealism that had nothing to do with, or at least that was separate from any kind of anti-Semitism or hate or the motivation, we tend to think, well, someone who was a Nazi, it must have been because they hated, you know, they were filled with hate. But someone like my grandmother described her experience as being idealistic about what Hitler had to offer when he started talking about putting these youth programs together that would mix up the lower class, you know, the children who came from like factory worker backgrounds mm-hmm. together with the children of aristocrats on these mm-hmm. in these programs where they'd all be living together. So she had sort of embraced perversely this kind of this idea that it was like equal, you know, there was some sort of diversity, mm-hmm. you know, obviously not within really this, it was right. all within the German race. But anyway, I thought that was fascinating, and I feel myself to be someone who's very wary of idealism of all stripes because of that, because I think she was a living example of how misled her own idealism was.
Going a little bit deeper in that, so there's this part in the book where this conversation where Anya and her daughter, years after the main events happen, where her daughter asks her, quote, "Weren't you alarmed by all of the racist talk, Hitler's rants about the Jewish virus and the noble German? You can't read more than four sentences by the man without knowing he was a racist fanatic." And Anya says, "I didn't notice." Why is this vantage point, this specific point, for those who didn't notice, really an important part of the story to tell?
I think that it's part of the human story part of our struggle in life is to figure out what's going on around us and make sense of it and notice the things that are happening for what they are. And I think the Germany in the 1930s and during World War II is a horrific cautionary tale of many people who didn't notice.
We've heard, of course, in reading about your book, and actually a lot of comments after your op-ed piece, that there are lots of parallels to today. And what's your take on that?
Yeah, I think that I guess my main take is that I think people are really interested in looking at this time, including myself, but from new angles and new ways, because for so long we've looked at the Holocaust in a almost like this sort of horrific fairy tale like structure, this real sort of black and white, and we've looked at the villains closely and we've looked at the victims, but not so much the many, many people in between. Mm. And I think that feels increasingly relevant to people today, to think about who were those people and what were they thinking and how did they let this happen?
You said earlier when we talked about your grandmother, you knew, but then you didn't know. And that really brings to light for me, we had this discussion with the folks from the Anti-Defamation League about the rise of anti-Semitic hateful incidents here in our state. And most of those incidents are happening with young people who are writing swastikas on walls and inside of school or comments and things like that. I'd like to know from your vantage point, what do you think is happening here at this point in this time in history, where we have these young people who are taking this up in this way?
I think that some of this is kind of like we live in this huge world, and it's an increasingly global world, and there's information coming at us from all sides about what's happening in Syria, what's happening in Germany, what's happening in France, what's happening in Russia. And people are bombarded by this, and they, especially, I would imagine, young people have no... it's hard to chart your way, and then they get drawn to these sort of simple answers. Certainly that's what happened in Germany. People were looking for very simple narratives to sign on to, and that can be so dangerous. And I think that maybe there's, I mean, it's not my field to, I don't know enough about what's happening with the rise of anti-Semitism in Massachusetts specifically today, but I think that this kind of oversimplifying and this being drawn to symbols of power that make you feel somehow like this, your own little tribe is, you're shored up by that, is maybe part of it.
You talked a bit about in your op-ed piece your feelings about, of course, this push and pull, this love for your grandmother, but really like this disdain for what she had been a part of. I'd love for you, though, to talk just a little bit more in the few moments that we have about what you want people to take away from reading this type of story in your book, that person who was in the middle, or maybe you can sympathize with this person at the same time as feel disdain for them.
I think that, I mean, I want people to take away from my book just a good story with characters that they relate to and are interested in, because that's what I want from books that I read, with plot. But I want people also, I guess, I hope that through looking at this point, this time, from what was going on with ordinary Germans in this gray area, people start to reflect on themselves. Mm. And that there's, instead of seeing the Nazi as the sort of monstrous, unrelatable figure, you see him as somebody who might share some terrifying things with you.
Mm. Well, this is Jessica Shattuck. She's a Brookline-based author of The Women in the Castle. Jessica, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Radio Boston.